Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West brings us inside Texas politics. They got their own stock market now. They've got control of the border. What do they need from us? Maybe not. Well, they got Congresswoman Crockett, too. That's nice. And also today, it's kind of good. The First Lady is going to be in action. First time in a long time, she is going to be doing something important, we think. She is going to be making remarks at the State Department for the International Women of Courage Award. Also, it's April Fool's Day. When asked, 32% of you are annoyed by it. 32% think that these pranks are harmless. 26% say they're fun. I'm annoyed by it. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
People sometimes think that under the Biden administration that he was simply asleep at the switch. No. They weren't asleep at the switch. It was a massive, large-scale program to import as many illegals as possible, ultimately to change the entire voting map of the United States.
And he proves it, and we'll talk about that. Elon Musk on the trail in Wisconsin. They had a mission, and it was thwarted. The Biden administration was not incompetent. You just heard it when it comes to the broken border. It was intentional. We reveal what Doge has found and what Tom Homan and his men are doing to fix it.
Number two.
Why tonight matters for Democrats is this is a chance for them to get off the mat. Like a big showing, a big win tonight, that's going to bring in money, energy. But I can tell you that inside the Republican Party, not a lot of optimism about Wisconsin. Down in Florida, feeling great.
Wow, there you go. A special election with gigantic implications today. We look at the stakes and the worry both sides have in Wisconsin and Florida.
Number one.
We have seen six high-profile university presidents resign, two of which are from Columbia, because these university presidents have failed to show moral, strong leadership. And President Trump, as he campaigned on, is holding them accountable.
Lee Stefanik, we have seen six high-profile university presidents resign. Gunning for the Ivy, you just heard that. The arrogant anti-Semitic Ivy League colleges have the financial future in peril as the Trump administration is finding the troublemakers and examining the university funding with Harvard and Princeton now getting the unwanted attention Columbia was receiving, and massive panic is setting in. Steph Kite joins us now from Axios. Steph, I'm not going to start where I just ended. I want to start in the special election. So between the Gates seat and the Walt seat, what seat are Republicans more worried about?
It's definitely the Walt seat, which is where, you know, they feel like they have a weaker candidate running to replace him. But, you know, it is remarkable that they're worried at all about these seats. When you look at both of these two Florida seats, the Gates that was vacated by Matt Gaetz, Trump won by 37 points last year, and Gaetz himself won by 32 points. And then you look at the Mike Walt seat, which Walt won by 33 points, Trump won by 30 points last year. So, like, this is a very red area. And so the fact that this is competitive at all, even if Republicans win, which is still most likely, the people I've spoken to still think they end up, you know, safely winning these races at the end of the day. But the fact that this is competitive at all is a sign of, you know, how concerning this could be if this becomes a national trend. Special elections, obviously, you know, are hard to fully gauge where, you know, the public is at large. There's often turnout issues. It can be harder to campaign there just because there's not as much attention, and candidate quality really matters. However, if we see these kinds of close races in you know, districts that should be very safe, it's going to be concerning to Republicans, and Democrats are going to use it as leverage and tout it as a sign that the American people are mm-hmm. not excited about what Trump is doing.
So here's Randy Fine, that candidate that managed to alienate the popular governor, Ron DeSantis, in a mm-hmm. district that he basically, before they redistrict, he basically was representing before he ran for Congress, before he ran for governor. Cut 15.
The issue we have is that Democrats are angry because every time Donald Trump wins, they lose. They want open borders. They don't want to stop the waste, fraud, and abuse. And so they voted, and a majority of Republicans haven't, and we need them to go and vote. My race is simple. I'm endorsed by Donald Trump. He asked me to run. My opponent just got endorsed by Bernie Sanders. He describes himself as a proud socialist. And so voters have to decide what they want, the Trump agenda to continue or a socialist.
So, and there you see. So Randy Fine evidently didn't put a lot of energy into this, and he was outraised almost 9-1. So we'll see what happens. And you really think Jimmy Patronis will prevail right now? On the other seat?
I think at this point, I think it is safer than Waltz's district. But, you know, we have to see. Again, it's really hard to predict with these special election races. When you're looking at polling, it's usually small numbers. It's hard to get a gauge of what kind of turnout we could see in these seats. So, you know, both are certainly going to be more competitive than anyone thought they were going to be. Republicans feel like they should be able to pull them off anyway, but the closeness is going to be remarkable.
All right, so let's talk about what's happening in Wisconsin now. I had the Republican candidate on today, and then you have George Soros. George Soros is supporting the Democrat, and then you have Elon Musk come in late, and he starts campaigning for the Republican, and then the Democrats change their step. They change their approach. Instead of running on abortion, which everyone seems to run on the left, they started running against Musk. As much money as he brought in, is that motivating Democrats more than Trump?
Could be. I mean, you could see that backfiring and potentially energizing Democratic voters in Wisconsin. And of course, Wisconsin is an important battleground state. It's different from the situation in Florida, where these are red districts where maybe there's not the excitement that Republicans need to win them. In Wisconsin, you have Republicans and Democrats who are engaged voters who are just coming out of, you know, a battleground year, you know, presidential election year. And you could see a world in which, you know, on one hand, Elon Musk and Donald Trump focus on the race there, energizing Republican voters. But you could also see that backfiring. There is a lot of anger that we're seeing from Democratic voters toward Elon Musk in particular and some of the work he's been doing with Doge. And so you could see his actions there and, you know, kind of the idea of giving money to voters to kind of to try to get people to turn out. Angering Democrats in a way that then convinces them that it's important for them to turn out. And certainly the Democratic Party views it as something that they can capitalize on.
Right. So we'll see what happens. It's going to be Schimmel against Patterson. You have Obama and you have Bernie Sanders and Pritzker and George Soros again against Musk and Trump. At stake, maybe three seats that could be gerrymandered differently. So you write today about what Doge is doing. Now, if you look at what Bret Baier did over the last 2 days, and I encourage everyone to go to Fox Nation and just watch the interview with seven business leaders that volunteered basically their time to give it all up at least for 6 months and work with Elon Musk to try to streamline and make efficient all these departments. It was sober. It was non-political. It was factual. They talked about the computers being 50, 60 years old. They talked about the problems with these computers not talking to each other, a way to undo and find the $500 billion in fraud the GAO says is in there. There was nothing political about it. But yet, politically, Doge seemed to be getting a beating because of maybe some information that got out, mistakes they made about people being fired, then hired back. So what do you think about Doge's impact on the Republican Party overall?
I mean, it's pretty interesting to talk to senators. You know, I spend most of my day talking to senators about Doge and how they view things. And I think generally Republicans and the American public agree that there is, you know, kind of waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government that should be trimmed down. There's general support for the idea of Doge. But where it gets tricky is when it gets down to the details and the impact of some of the decisions that Doge has been making and sort of the speed at which Doge moves. You know, a lot of Republicans, you know, are quick to say, yeah, they support what Elon Musk is doing, but that they feel like he's moving too quickly and not taking time to really make sure the right people are being let go, that they're not impacting, you know, veterans working at Veterans Affairs, for example, or some of the other decisions that have sparked a lot of backlash. And it's also, you know, when you're making these cuts, it is going to impact specific communities. And there are federal workers across the country, not just in Washington, D.C. And so that's where we're also seeing some concern from certain Republican senators and lawmakers who feel like, you know, some of the cuts are impacting their own constituents in a way that's not helpful. So, you know, there is a lot of support, but kind of when you get into the details, when you start seeing the impact from some of the actions they've been taking, you see problems there. And also there's just a general sense of them moving too quickly. I interviewed Senator Jim Justice in West Virginia, and he similarly told me that he's happy generally with the work that Elon Musk and Doge is doing, but that he feels like they've mowed past the fence, that they've maybe gone a little bit too far in some instances, and that when that happens, he just hopes that they're able to course correct and fix where they've gone too far.
Right. So he said he's worried about Medicare, and he says that 28% of West Virginians depend on Medicare for their health care. But with their new, it is not cutting benefits, but they are looking at eligibility. In these states, they are looking to stop fraud and when it comes to Medicaid or Medi-Cal out in California, and stop people from getting being double dipping in two or three states with the same person. But because the state computer systems don't talk with each other, you're able to get away with a lot of this stuff. So that's where a lot of things come in. Barack Obama dramatically expanded the amount of people eligible for Medicaid. That's really not an affordable situation.
And that's where, you know, the devil is going to be in the details as congressional Republicans continue to hash out this massive package that they have been working on that will include border money and extending Trump's tax cuts from 2017, but also these spending cuts to try to balance some of the spending that they will be signing off on. And Medicaid is going to be the big debate. We've heard President Trump say that Medicaid will not be touched. There are many Republicans who want to follow through on that. But then you also have conversations around adding work requirements, for example, which is something that Senator Justice told me he would be supportive of that could, you know, be a cost-saving measure. And also there's these discussions about the expansion and whether there would be changes to expanded access to Medicaid in a way that would also save money. And that's where it gets really tricky. And you hear even from Republicans who are not sure that that's something that they could actually get behind. For example, Senator Josh Hawley is another one who has expressed concern about doing anything that would maybe impact even the expansion of Medicaid. So these are still early conversations, but this could be a potentially really big issue that divides some Republicans. And of course, in both chambers, neither leader can afford to lose very many.
Right. Where are we at with the big, beautiful bill? I understand the Senate's moving first. Are they moving on two paths or one path?
They're moving on the one big, beautiful bill idea at this point, given the House passed that and President Trump has made it clear that that's the path that he wants to take. And so they are looking to move as soon as this week. Majority Leader John Thune told reporters yesterday that their expectation still is that they're able to move forward with that bill this week. It's kind of a compromise bill between what the House passed and some of the issues that the Senate really cares about. For example, the House version of the budget resolution did not make Trump's 2017 tax cuts permanent, which is something the Senate wants to do. The president would also like to do as long as they can get it past the Senate parliamentarian. There's a little bit of some tricky in the weeds rules that they have to make sure everything is good with to do that. So they're looking at doing that this week, but an exact date for that vote is not clear just yet.
It's just unbelievable. I mean, that's why Elise Stefanik amazingly said, okay, I'm not going to be UN ambassador. The president asked her to go back. Do you think that that's why is the president worried about Florida? Do you think that's the main reason?
That is what we have been hearing with folks as we've been talking about that kind of last minute decision to pull her nomination to be, ambassador to the UN. It was just, a week or so before that our indication was that they were ready to go and had planned to get her confirmed as soon as those Florida seats were filled. But I do think the president is anxious about those Florida seats. The other side of this is that clearly the House has very slim margins. Johnson was able to get through their budget resolution despite some concerns from Freedom Caucus folks. But there are going to be, some of those more conservative folks are going to be increasingly uneasy with voting for these packages, especially when it includes raising the debt ceiling and other issues that they're not always comfortable with. So, Johnson can use as many votes as he can get. And I think that was also a factor in the president's decision.
Amazing. So much drama going on, Steph. You can't say your job is boring.
Certainly not.
Steph Kite, thanks so much with Axios. Appreciate it. When we come back, open up the phones, 1-866-408-7669. I also want to talk a lot about what's happening overseas and here at home. The President of the United States is moving forward. He's moving forward on immigration. He got blocked again when it comes to deportation of 600,000 plus Venezuelans who've had temporary protective status put in by Joe Biden. So the new president wants to reverse it. A judge says no. Not kidding. Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
On the latest episode of the Fox Nation Investigates podcast, Evil Next Door, female serial killer Eileen Wuornos, a Florida-bound hitchhiking prostitute, rose to infamy after killing seven men. Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
People sometimes think that under the Biden administration that he was simply asleep at the switch. No. They weren't asleep at the switch. It was a massive, large-scale program to import as many illegals as possible, ultimately to change the entire voting map of the United States and disenfranchise the American people and make it a permanent, deep blue, one-party state from which there would be no escape.
The thing, while he was campaigning Elon Musk in Green Bay, he brought out one of his Doge guys, Antonio Gracias, who's a business expert, self-made multimillionaire. And he did some studying. And one thing he wanted to do is look at Social Security. And then they realized, why are all these Social Security numbers going out the door? And then he started looking at how many Social Security numbers were handed out to non-citizens. And in terms of past years, this was astronomically increased under Joe Biden. And when you have a Social Security number, do you vote? That's the scary thing. In many cases, the answer is yes, even though it's illegal. Listen to Gracias, cut 26.
This number, what this is when you come in the country, if you're an illegal, there's a couple ways to come in. You come in through a port of entry, and you can tell them you're afraid. And they'll give you an asylum case. You get an interview. Then you get in. That's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to just go to the border. You walk up to a Border Patrol officer, and you tell them you want to come in. They have a couple of choices. They could charge you with a misdemeanor or a felony under 1325, or they can make it an administrative offense, like a parking ticket, basically. They were told to do that, make it an administrative offense under the last administration. And then you walk across the border. They do what's called a release your own recognizance, and they give you an NTA, a notice to appear, which is to appear at a judge. The wait times on judges are like average 6 years. Look at Grok, you'll see it on immigration judges. Once you're in the country, you can apply for a work document. And then Social Security Administration automatically sends you in the mail your Social Security number. No interview, no ID.
It went on, cut 27.
Look, if I hadn't seen this myself, I'm not sure I'd have believed it. I went through it myself and mapped it. And Elon is right. This is true. The defaults in the system from Social Security to all of the benefit programs have been set to max inclusion, max pay for these people. And minimum collection. That's what's happening. We found 1.3 million of them already on Medicaid, as an example. We've gone through on every benefit program we went through, we found groups from this particular group of people, this 5.5 million people, in those benefit programs. And then what was really, really disturbing us was why. We're asking ourselves why. Right. And so we actually just took a sample and looked at voter registration records. And we found people here registered to vote in this population, yes.
And who did vote?
Who did vote? 5.5 million. So Medicaid, Medicare, they let everybody get it in California. But how about 5.5 million in our country? 1.3 they knew were already getting it. Think about everything they're getting. Unemployment, who knows? That's the money you earned.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We started at the top of the system, mapping the whole system of Social Security to understand where all the fraud was. And there's a lot of great people there that showed us really a lot of waste. And so that came up with a big list of stuff they're working on. You've heard some of that already. But this is what jumped out at us. When we saw these numbers, we were like, what is this? In 21, you see 270,000 people, goes all the way to 2.1 million in 24. These are non-citizens that are getting Social Security numbers.
Yeah, this is a mind-blowing chart.
Yeah, just this literally blew us away.
And it happened under Joe Biden, and it was intentional, not accidental. There was a plan, and they got Social Security numbers, and they said that a lot of these people voted in the last election. Can you imagine if Donald Trump had not won, and still all the damage that Joe Biden has done with the Criminals running rampant in our country. We've already, Tom Homan has already gotten rid of 110,000 illegals, and some of which are in a supermax prison in El Salvador. A lot of other people are self-deporting because they know what's coming. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, Dallas County Republican Party Chair, American Constitutional Rights Union Executive Director, former congressman from Florida. Colonel, what's your thoughts about that revelation revealed by Doge on that stage in Green Bay?
Well, I got to tell you, down south we have a saying that a hit dog will holler. And I think that's why you see so much protestations coming from the Democrat Party and the left, because all of these things are being revealed to people. And you're right. This is part of that fundamental transformation that Barack Obama talked about back in 2008. We now that know that the Biden administration not just was undermining our sovereignty and our constitutional republic, they were actively, you know, awarding people with Social Security numbers and having, you know, legal law-abiding citizens pay for people that are here illegally and providing them taxpayer benefits and also getting these people the opportunity to be able to vote. This is treasonous. I don't know any other way to classify this, but I'm sure that the left will just blow it over and continue to call Elon Musk, you know, these disparaging things and attack Tesla dealerships.
And it's been nonstop, too. But now they're prosecuting these people, and I can't wait for them to spend significant time in jail. And, of course, give up who's actually writing the checks for them to do this. These aren't organic people stepping up to blow up the thing they live for, and that's the electric car. I mean, they're blowing up an electric car, which I think New York and California are two states in which they're going to outlaw the combustion engine. What are they thinking, blowing up the number one electric car in the country?
Well, it's so, you know, the hypocrisy is laughable because think about the Biden administration telling us, what, 6-8 months ago that they were going to mandate for us to have to go out and buy electric vehicles. And you're right, New York and California. But now all of a sudden, because of the revelations of what Elon Musk is bringing to us, which everyone should want to know. Who would not want to know that we have millions of people on the Social Security rolls that are here illegally, should not be on Social Security rolls, and being able to vote? You would think that everyone in America would say that that is wrong. But yet, instead of saying that, they're going after the people that are revealing it. And look at Mark Kelly, the senator from Arizona, who all of a sudden decides that he doesn't want a Tesla anymore. He doesn't want his electric vehicle. So he goes out and buys a big gas guzzler.
Two of them.
So, yeah, two of them. So they weren't serious about this thing the whole time. But, again, let's come back to this whole thing about the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin. This is one of the reasons why it's so important, because they want to undo a lot of the voter laws that were passed during Governor Scott Walker's time that's enshrined in the Constitution in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, they do. And they'll probably be able to pick up three or four seats if the Republican doesn't win, which is why Elon Musk is out there and very much engaged. I want to talk about the immigration rest, too, and these what these judges are doing. So we have a judge drop these to the protected, temporary protective status of Venezuelans. We've got 600,000 here. Well, the president, a new president comes in and says, I'm not keeping 600,000 people. We got to pay for them. Let them go back to their own countries. And a judge says, no, that's racist. They said that it was a racist move to have Trump do this and say one of the reasons that they're giving that they need to protective status, inflation. Excuse me. That's not how you get asylum, inflation.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great? I guess, you know, we should have had Americans leaving to go to I don't know what country because of the inflation of the Biden administration. But this is, again, an example of judicial activism, not interpreting the law. And this, again, is an example of these leftist judges that are getting in the way of Donald Trump doing what he's supposed to do, which is to protect the sovereignty and provide the safety and security for the American people and to ensure that the folks that are here in America are here legally. They are guests legally, or they are citizens. And so this is why these judicial elections are so important. And many times people don't pay attention to it. And I hope that we have a good, strong turnout up in Wisconsin today, because we don't want to see these things happen there in that state.
Right. And what about Florida? If you lose any one of those, that would be a disaster. To me, almost Scott Brown-like when he upset the Democrat during Obama's first months and when Ted Kennedy passed away. That's how big it'll be. If you take Walz's seat or Gaetz's seat,
Yeah, it'll be huge. And one of the things we have to come to understand is that these are districts that Donald Trump won anywhere from, what, 25 to 30% just in November of last year. But yet we see the Democrats dumping boatloads of money. I mean, we're talking about 7 to 1, 10 to 1, the money that they're flowing into there to try to do exactly what you're talking about. And so, again, we need to make sure this is a turnout election. But when I hear the left talk about, oh, Elon Musk is on up there and he's trying to by an election. You know, George Soros, what do you think he does? And all these other big beneficiaries on the left side, look at what's happening, like you say, in these two special elections in the 1st Congressional District and 6th Congressional District in Florida. So it's important that we hold on to those, and hopefully it won't even be close.
Yeah, so let's talk about what's happening with our colleges. In real time, the president is putting them under scrutiny. Now he's possibly going to take back millions of dollars in grants to Harvard, because he put it on hold as they investigate anti-Semitism on the campus. They get $8 billion overall, but he's talking about hundreds of millions that are going to go on hold because they refuse to crack down on anti-Semitic behavior and, I think, also anti-American behavior along with the faculty. Now they're getting really nervous. They're talking about all the research that won't be taking place, all the diseases that won't be followed up on. But this is something they should have thought out before, and I'm stunned it's happening at this rate. I mean, we saw Columbia, but now we see a situation where a Yale spokesman said this. Over the last few weeks, Yale has repeatedly requested to, first off, let me get the other quote here. Here we go. This is from Alan Garber, the university president. She says, if this funding is stopped, it will halt life-saving research and imperil important scientific research and innovation. The government has informed us that they are considering this action because they are concerned that the university has not fulfilled its obligation to curb and combat anti-Semitic harassment. We fully embrace this important goal of combating anti-Semitism, one of the most whatever. We have strengthened our rules and approached the discipline. Disciplining those who violate them. We have enhanced training. So they are extremely worried about losing $8.7 billion. And I love it. They're shook to the core. They also have threatened to get rid of, and he is now self-deported, an Iran-born Yale scholar who finally got fired when he wouldn't submit to an interview to answer questions about him running a charity, a scam charity affiliated with Iran. All this scrutiny is causing these actions.
Well, you know, we've got to look at these colleges and universities and cease them from being petri dishes for anti-Semitism, radicalism, and support to Islamic jihadism and terrorism. They've been going along doing this for far too long. And look, I don't have any sympathy for these Ivy League schools. Let them dip into their endowment funds, which are in the billions of dollars on top of that. But the American taxpayer dollars should not be going to fund universities that are harboring this type of radicalism.
Well, absolutely not.
And look, I've seen it face-to-face at the University of Buffalo. You guys covered it at Fox News when I had to be escorted off the campus by police because, you know, folks were upset with me because I was speaking that America was not a racist nation. You know, I'm a kid born in 1961 in a segregated hospital. I think I should be able to speak and articulate that to young people. But this is what is happening on our college and university campuses, and we should not be funding it.
All right, so the question is, are this just anti-Semitism where people rise up and they say to themselves, you know, Israel's the bad guy, or is it supported by Hamas? To me, it goes right to funding overseas with these international students coming over here. I have no idea why they're getting slots over American kids, especially this Khalil, who's a guy that had no academic outstanding achievements, was sitting there from Syria working for a Palestinian group in England and gets to go to Columbia. I love that. Mark Goldfeder is representing 8 hostage families, and he says there's a direct link between the groups on Columbia and Hamas. Listen to his facts. Cut 7.
Students for Justice in Palestine and Within Our Lifetime, which are two of the groups that we just sued in the Southern District of New York. Here, by the way, is a thank you letter they got afterwards from the PFLP, another Hamas-affiliated terrorist organization, thanking them for their service to Hamas. And the beautiful part is when you hire these useful idiots to be your PR agents on American campuses. What you get are useful idiots who make useful idiot mistakes. So, for example, here is an actual recruitment flyer for Hamas that they handed out on campus, and it reads, "This is an intentional and coordinated effort to uphold the principles of Hamas, the PFLP, and the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade."
Where did that appear?
September 24th, 2024, on Columbia's campus, handed it out by the CUAD, the group that Mahmoud Khalil represents.
That's the guy that's in, that wants to be have his hearing in New Jersey, but sits in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. There was a 31-year-old graduate student who graduated still on campus housing. This is unbelievable that we allowed this to happen.
Well, Brian, I tell you something. Right now, I am holding in my hand the Muslim Brotherhood Strategic Plan for America. This was an official document that was produced in 1991, written by Muhammad Akram. It was found during an FBI search in Falls Church, Virginia in 2004, and it was part of the 2008 Holy Land terror funding trial. You would be surprised at all the groups that are listed, which will enable this civilizational jihad against America. These are the groups that are doing it right now, Students for Justice in Palestine. And I will tell you, you should probably do an expose on the Muslim Brotherhood Strategic Plan for America. It is eye-opening. It is shocking. And we all know the Muslim Brotherhood is nothing more than Hamas in the United States of America. And we are allowing this to happen. And right now, we got a breaking story right here in Garland, Texas, where we live. There is a mosque that is a recruiting platform for Islamic jihadism and terrorism right here in Garland, Texas, where I live. So this is what's going on. That's why we need Tom Homan.
Yeah. By the way, Muslim Brotherhood found the 1920s in Egypt, and we got Al-Qaeda and everything else spun out of that, as is Hamas.
Yes.
And Hezbollah, even Sunni and Shia see eye to eye when it comes to extremist behavior to oust Western values and Christians in particular. Thanks so much, Colonel. Busy time.
Always a pleasure.
But the good news is your border's under control for the first time in our lifetime, or at least our adult life. Thanks so much, Colonel.
God bless. Take care, Brian.
All right. 1-866-408-7669. I'll finish this hour with some of your emails. You can write me at briankilmeade.com. Just a quick reminder, Dayton, Ohio, WHIO. Listeners, I'll be on stage June 21st, History, Liberty, and Laughs. It's going to be an inspirational, aspirational, patriotic night. It's also sponsored with One Nation, with Fox Nation. You're going to get specials there just for attending. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I went on Bill's show, I went on his podcast, and I said, man, you know, nothing happens if people don't break bread together and meet face-to-face. He's been one of the president's hardest critics, and we came to dinner, me, Bill, Dana White, and it could not have been better. Everyone was so surprised, so pleasant. The most shocking thing to me was, you know, Bill's obviously a very big liberal, been very hard on the president, but he's donated a lot of money to other politicians. You know, you've had Biden, Clinton, Obama, everybody. He had never been to the White House, and the president was so gracious. He took us up to the private residence. We saw the Gettysburg Address in the Lincoln bedroom, and I was like, you've never been here, Bill? And I was like, how about this? President Trump, you know, extending this olive branch, and we talked about things we had in common, you know, ending wokeness, you know, securing the border. Right. You know, the president was asking him what he thought about policy, you know, going on with Iran and Israel and things. It was it blew my mind. It was right. I was, you know, very, very proud.
And he should be, because Kid Rock set it up. Bob Ritchie set the whole thing up. He's friends with Bill Maher on his show. He's a big fan of Trump. He says, you're both my friends. Why don't I bring you over? Now, if Rachel Maddow went over, it would have been a total phony thing. And then it would have been like, how do they get along? But Bill Maher does not surprise me. I think 50% of Bill's show is outraged that his Democrats have totally let him down, outraged at the cancel culture that really went after the comedy community first and began to, you know, ostracize people and acting and all these other things and celebrities, and also made his life a little bit unpleasant. And he was embarrassed. He was embarrassed by a lot of the regulations that no one was announcing that Joe Biden's cognitive failure was happening, that the border was a collapse, that Afghanistan was a catastrophe, and no one was acknowledging that. And then he sees what's happening on the West Coast, people moving out, taxes through the roof, everything burned to the ground, a ridiculous mayor who was in Ghana at the time, even though she knew the fire was burning out of control. So all those things, I think, had them sit down with each other, and I think they probably agree with 60%. Now, that was Kid Rock just an hour ago on Fox and Friends. So I'm sure Bill Maher's going to come out. I don't think Bill Maher's going to have anything negative to say, just judging by the type of person Trump is socially and the people he hung out with years before he even ran for office. They sued each other for a while about things they were saying about each other. So I find this interesting. Gavin Newsom, just talking about the toxic nature of this, Gavin Newsom, who is actually responsible for so much toxicity with his own party, actually tries to remove himself again. Just like the failures on the fires, he's like, I got to get to the bottom of this. Listen to what he's saying now. Cut 33.
These guys are crushing us. The Democratic brand is toxic right now. We had a high water mark 2 weeks ago, and that was a CNN poll at 29% favorability. It's dropped in the NBC poll down to 27%. It's one thing to make noise, but you also have to make sense. And I think it's important. Democrats, we tend to be a little more judgmental than we should be. This notion of cancel culture, you've been living it. You've been on the receiving end of it for years and years and years. That's real. And Democrats need to own up to that. They've got to mature about this.
And if he did change to anything, for example, there's this bill in place. Courts are going to rule on whether a boy, the trans men should be playing in boys, should be playing in women's sports. If Gavin Newsom was really somebody who saw the light, he'd come out and say, it's not right. I feel bad for people in the trans community, but it's not right. But he doesn't say a word, and it's happening right in California. Hank's in Virginia. Hey, Hank.
Hey, buddy, how you doing?
Great. What's
Love
on your mind?
Number one on the radio. I just think, you know, everybody knows Elon Musk is like, he's like the Ben Franklin of our time, and we love Trump. I just think they could do a little bit better messaging before anything starts and just give an explanation of what they're going to do, like the who, what, where, and why. I just think if they do that, I think it'll be come out much better because, you know, the Democrats, they're in lockstep.
I know, but if, Hank, just watch Fox Nation, watch Special Report. They did an hour with all the Doge guys, what exactly they're doing. Just a quick note about, and thanks so much for the call, Hank, and the kind words on the show. How about what Elon Musk is doing? He is working now with Neuralink, the company he founded. He thinks they're going to be able to try in a human what they've been doing with animals, restoring sight in blind people. Besides that, electric cars going into space and trying to get to Mars, tunnels to beat traffic. I'm not really sure what he's accomplished. Sarcasm, well intact. Yeah, that's what they're going to be doing.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Here you go, everybody. Let's get going. Patrick Murphy is going to be on the bottom of the hour. The Democratic perspective on everything from what Kid Rock set up yesterday with Bill Maher and the President of the United States. To the tariff situation. He's got a business background along with the direction the Democratic Party is going. Varney and Company will do a simulcast where we'll talk about what's happening with colleges in America. I think the Trump administration is just probably at everything they've done. This is the most heartening. What they're trying to do with higher education, I didn't think it was possible to do something this massive, this quick. But they are rocking our lead institutions to the bone, and you know it's rippling down to the others that don't have the power and the endowments that these guys have. But just to know, anti-Semitism is not going to rage, anti-Americanism is not going to be part of the curriculum without a lot of blowback is significant. So we'll do that, and Michael Wilds in 15 minutes. He's one of the elite immigration attorneys in our country. I want to get his perspective on some of these people here on student visas, that they're anti-American, pro-Hamas behavior. We'll talk about that and the chances of total deportation. But right now, they're in holding tanks across the country. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
People sometimes think that under the Biden administration that he was simply asleep at the switch. No. They weren't asleep at the switch. It was a massive, large-scale program to import as many illegals as possible, ultimately to change the entire voting map of the United States.
It's totally true, and that's what Elon Musk's research has shown. They had a mission, and it was thwarted. The Biden administration was not incompetent when it comes to the broken border. It was intentional. We reveal what Doge has found and what Tom Homan and his men are doing to fix it.
Number two.
Why tonight matters for Democrats is this is a chance for them to get off the mat. Like a big showing, a big win tonight, that's going to bring in money, energy. But I can tell you that inside the Republican Party, not a lot of optimism about Wisconsin. Down in Florida, feeling great.
Maybe. I actually think they feel good about Wisconsin, too. Special election with gigantic implications today. We're going to look at the stakes in Wisconsin and Florida soon.
Number one.
We have seen six high-profile university presidents resign, two of which are from Columbia, because these university presidents have failed to show moral, strong leadership. And President Trump, as he campaigned on, is holding them accountable.
Well, she is. Lee Stefanik is, too. Gunning for the Ivy, the arrogant anti-Semitic Ivy League colleges have their financial future in peril as the Trump administration is finding the troublemakers and examining the university funding, with Harvard, Princeton, and Columbia now getting the unwanted attention. So let's talk about that. It's pretty amazing. Number one, that Harvard gets $8.5 billion from the federal government, your money, in order to fund research, they say, and keep that elite institution elite, while they continue to get international students to pay full freight, and they get in over American students. That is a subplot story to the bigger story about immigration in our country. And what we're seeing now is the attention that Columbia is getting because of their anti-Semitic behavior that was taking place, I guess, started three or about a month ago. Now, this is the first time it really kicked in under President Trump. They don't fully realize what Trump's going to do and how much this bothered him, the anti-Semitism, the anti-Americanism on the campus, the ungratefulness, the arrogance, and, you know, the disdain that they have for Trump's America, red America, or maybe America overall. So Chuck Schumer, Jewish guy, New York, powerful Democrat, doesn't care about anti-Semitism at Columbia, doesn't care about Harvard. They say 22 major institutions did it. Okay. Well, you're going to start caring now because there's, I think, I got to get the millions down right. In terms of Harvard, they're starting to look at Harvard right now. And with Harvard, you see $8.5 billion total. But you also see a situation with the campus chaos where they have are looking at the same thing with $255 million in contracts, $8.7 billion in grants. And they have a task force looking at anti-Semitism. They said, hold on, not a dime until we find out how bad the situation is, outline what it's going to take to keep that money. But for now, you don't get that money. Panic on the Harvard campus. Alan Garber writes, if the funding is stopped, it will halt life-saving research and imperil important scientific research and innovation. Goes on to say that we look at anti-Semitism as a problem and are addressing it. You saw what Columbia did on Friday. They said, we're going to adhere to all nine demands from the Trump administration. Can we have the $400 million? Problem is, there's still anti-Semitic demonstrations taking place right outside the campus. You still have these guys covering their faces with their masks, even though they were banned. And the day after they pledged to go along with the new sheriff being in town, they said basically ignore it. One of the key things they're doing is looking at the curriculum in the Middle East and the Far East for these students and saying that's going to be in charge. They're going to have an independent provost set up the curriculum. The next day, the now resigned temporary interim president came out and said, yeah, ignore that. Don't worry about it. Really? You don't think anyone was watching that 75-minute teleconference? At which time, you saw the total insincerity. She resigned. In comes Claire Shipman, a left-wing former news anchor. She's going to be temporary by design, but you know she's not going to last. She's on record to having disdain for President Trump. So Linda McMahon is cracking down at higher education. They're revamping lower education. And we're going to be able to judge how they're doing by the scores on primary school and by the anti-Semitism in the higher education areas. Princeton's also getting additional scrutiny. Princeton's got a lot of grants, and they're going to be looked at too. I didn't think Princeton was an issue. I know on Dartmouth's campus, they actually gave in because these students wanted to pressure the administration, and Northwestern too, I think it is, to pressure the administration to divest from Israel, and they actually are going to divest from Israel. You got to be kidding me. Where does that come from? How do you go to school as a 19-year-old and said, I'm going to pick this institution and then get them to change what they invest in? Unless, of course, it's happening from another country, from another organization, from Hamas. Now, there's a direct link, no question about it. Lizzie Savetsky is a pro-Israel activist, just got back from Israel, and says these pro-Palestinian groups are really Hamas. Cut eight.
I had a mass protester on Columbia's campus last year, last spring, scream to me, "We are Hamas. We're all Hamas." It ended up, it was all over your network, actually, this clip of this person screaming this at me. But they've been telling us exactly who they are. And we have video footage of the terrorists in Gaza thanking their brothers at Columbia, referring to Columbia Apartheid Divest, the organization, this radical hate group on Columbia's campus that Mahmoud Khalil was leading the charge on. They were doing activities like leading an intifada teach-in that we were protesting outside of.
Trump administration is looking to, they're putting a pause on $210 million in funding to Princeton. Same thing. I mean, if this was anti-Muslim, you'd have every Democrat in the world standing up for this minority group. For some reason, they don't stand up for Jews. I don't understand it. But they're losing a lot of endowments because a lot of famous, successful people graduated from these institutions, and they're as befuddled as you are. So I'm just so heartened by this. Also in the curriculum, the anti-Americanism's got to stop. If you want to hire a conservative, don't teach your students how bad America is. You talk about slavery, you talk about Jim Crow, but understand how special this place is. You don't need propaganda. You just need the facts. And then Mark Goldfeder told me this on Sunday night on One Nation. He represents the families being held against their will by Hamas. Cut seven.
Students for Justice in Palestine and Within Our Lifetime, which are two of the groups that we just sued in the Southern District of New York. Here, by the way, is a thank you letter they got afterwards from the PFLP, another Hamas-affiliated terrorist organization, thanking them for their service to Hamas. And the beautiful part is when you hire these useful idiots to be your PR agents on American campuses, what you get are useful idiots who make useful idiot mistakes. So, for example, here is an actual recruitment flyer for Hamas that they handed out on campus, and it reads, "This is an intentional and coordinated effort to uphold the principles of Hamas, the PFLP, and the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigade."
Where did that appear?
September 24th, 2024, on Columbia's campus, handed it out by the CUAD,
by this guy
Mahmoud Khalil represents.
So, Mahmoud Khalil, please. And now you're going to bat for that guy? Now, someone just wrote me and they said, if you were told by the government that you're going to be put on a plane and deported to another country, I bet you'd want an opportunity to lawyer up and see a judge to contest that. That would be called the process. Right. If I was already, if I was here with an attorney, if you want to go get an attorney and you want to go through due process, maybe you should think about that ahead of time before you went and advocated for a enemy against America and a terrorist group. How about that? And then you better lawyer up and be ready to go because you're going to be deported on our will. You're here as a guest. Number two, if you were here illegally and you put on a plane brought to El Salvador, my heart doesn't go out to you because you already breached our border, came here illegally. All bets are off for your rights. That's in my view. You feel differently? I'm more than willing to take your call, 1-866-408-7669. Or if you prefer to write, briankilmeade.com. Click on comments. When we come back, Patrick Murphy joins us, and then we'll do a simulcast on Varney & Company. Busy morning. Kid Rock set up a big meeting with Bill Maher. How did it go? I'll tell you when we come back.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's so incredible because if you had told me, you know, a month ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, that there was something that the government could do to stop the absolute downward fall of these universities from grace, I wouldn't have believed you. But it turns out that if you simply say to them, "No more money until you stop discriminating against a minority population on your campus," suddenly they get their act together and they acquiesce to the demands of the government.
It is kind of interesting. That's Bhatia Sargon talking about what's happening with Princeton, Harvard, and Columbia. All their money is put on pause. We know the University of Pennsylvania, $175 million, because they will not stop trans men for being in women's sports. Joining us now is Michael Wilds, managing partner in Wilds and Weinberg, adjunct professor at Benjamin N. Cardoza School of Law, and former federal prosecutor. Michael, your thoughts about some of the crackdown on the colleges, I guess, personally, because I know anti-Semitism really matters to you to fight against it. And number two, on the deportation of some of these international students.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having me. I don't know if you were listening right before you came back from commercial. You had a clip of John Lennon when he got his green card. It was my late father, my sainted father, I should say, who handled John's green card case.
Family friend,
so
right?
I don't know if that was cued purposefully to introduce me. So.
No, that runs on a loop, and I see him over your right shoulder. But Michael, in particular, are you heartened by the crackdown on the anti-Semitism?
So, first of all, there isn't a Jew that isn't appreciative of the kind of support that we're now getting. Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter. You're scared if you're on a campus and somebody's taking your mug and dove it off of you. They're barring you from going into classrooms. They're intimidating people who are not comfortable wearing their kippahs, their yarmulkes. It is a very heartening experience to know that there is support and that there is enforcement. It was unacceptable that I'm a mayor myself in New Jersey, Englewood, where I live, or a governor would not have stepped in. If it was other ethnicities, no doubt they would have stepped in. When the mayor and the governor didn't step in and the president did, it was very heartening. And again, I'm saying this because what's really actionable here, Brian, is the conduct, not the speech. If somebody wrote an op-ed and then got deported because of their thought, that would be actionable. But a person who is warping the First Amendment, if you would, locking people in a room, dealing with security and safety, and putting out content that is supporting a terrorist organization, giving it support, that runs into that old Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire, those fighting words doctrine. You don't have an absolute right to speak. You can't go into a movie theater and start screaming fire. You have the right to express yourself in your politics, but you can't physically cause harm to other people. It's the conduct that was actionable in those cases.
So let's talk about Khalil, Mahmoud Khalil. He is the guy that was at the head of this organization, these Palestinian groups. I was interviewed a lawyer yesterday, Mark Goldfeder, who says he's representing some of the hostage families, and they have direct links between these Palestinian groups on campus and the Hamas hostage holders and Hamas organization. I mean, they got to go, right? I mean, do you have to prove that in court?
They're paying them. These are professional rabble risers that are living on campus and they've already graduated. Why are they there? If their politic is something that they're being paid for, okay, express yourself, write something. Do not physically take action to bar people from classes or intimidate or incite a riot. Right. That to me is crossing a line. The president, to his credit, recognized it and put an end to it by pulling out the oxygen, the financial strings.
So I want you to hear what Marco Rubio said and tell me if that is enough for these students to be expelled. Listen.
It might be more than 300 at this point. We do it every day. Every time I find one of these lunatics, I take away their visa.
You're saying it could be more than 300 visas?
Sure, I hope. At some point, I hope we run out because we've gotten rid of all of them. But we're looking every day for these lunatics that are tearing things up.
And then he says they didn't come to, I didn't give them visas to come to this country to create uproar. They're here to study, not protest against us. Now tell us, I mean, that's how I feel, but you're the lawyer. If you represented some of these students and they're creating unrest, but they're not physically hurting people, they're coming out against Gaza and against Israel, but they're not hurting people, can I still throw them out if I'm Marco Rubio?
So a few things. First of all, the legal matrix that we're in. A student comes to America, they have an unrelinquished domicile that they're going to. If they eventually go through the visa system, get a green card, at any point, their actions, if it's in contradiction under that provision of law with our nation's security and policies, you do have a diminished expectation of rights. Even until you have the golden grail of a passport in your hand, you can be removed. I'm going to give you another anecdote and story. I'm the mayor of Englewood, New Jersey. We had 5 Kuwaiti students who saw a guy with a yarmulke who has a local pizza store sitting on a terrace and started berating and threatening his life. Not only did we have them prosecuted under state bias crimes, but we had Homeland Security pull their ticket. This was a year ago, more than a year ago. Why? Because you can't come to America and conduct yourself that way. You can express your freedom, your right to speak. The Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, gives all persons, doesn't say a visitor's visa or a citizen has greater rights. Yes, you can express yourself. It's your conduct that's actionable. And if you are giving financial aid and support, aiding and abetting a terrorist organization, I would argue that that's criminal. And those students should be prosecuted criminally if they can make a case.
Michael,
what I don't like is the visual. Forgive me, Brian. Well, what I don't like is the visual that there's no due process. Maybe they don't want to expose methods and procedures, but I think the more support of terrorist organizations that they can establish, the more that, again, we didn't like the visual in the bar, that is, where people, just because they had a tattoo, may be going to these terrible jails in El Salvador if it was expressive of autism and other important causes. So the important thing is to make exemplars or examples to show that there is a system in place to give people a proper day in court.
Right. It's an interesting time. Do you, real quick, do you think these Ivy League schools, 20 seconds, will get the message?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, the fact is there was a vacuum. Nobody cared to give the message. You said it artfully before this segment. Why, when it comes to Jews, can they get away with this and they can't with any other group?
Michael Wilde, you're the best. Thanks so much.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This Wisconsin race, you can talk about all the various ways in which it's seen as a proxy for a lot of things. But the Musk factor here is it's really much more of a referendum. It's been turned into a referendum on Elon Musk, even more than it is the Trump agenda. And I can tell you that there are Republicans all over Washington who quietly would be perfectly happy to see the Republican lose that race. Take some of the wind out of Elon Musk's sails. There are a lot of Capitol Hill Republicans who are concerned about having an increasingly unpopular Elon Musk put around their neck like an albatross going into the midterm elections. And they would like to be done with him give the president, President Trump, a sense that perhaps it's not in his or the party's best political interest to be seen as the party of Elon Musk. And losing this race in Wisconsin would have various negative implications for the Republican Party, but it would also take Elon Musk down a peg. And I can tell you, as I say, there are a lot of Republicans who wouldn't mind that happening.
So with Jeff's John Heilman, never a fan of Republicans, but I think the analysis could be solid. I think they got to do a better job at talking about what Elon Musk is doing. But Patrick Murphy joins us in studio. Patrick, as former congressman, too, and former acting secretary of the Army, the one thing, this is the first time they tried, instead of running on abortion, they ran against Elon Musk in Wisconsin with this court case. But Musk not backing down, put his money in, and then made a monster appearance over the weekend. How do you think that plays in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think people are upset. I mean, 9 in 10 Americans are angry right now, right? And this last election was a change election. I don't think Elon Musk is listening to President Trump. When President Trump says, hey, Elon, use a scalpel, not a hatchet. Hey, as we say in the military, ready, aim, fire, not fire, aim, ready. And I'm not just talking about the firings, but even when, you know, the interview last week, I thought Brett Baird did a phenomenal job. I listened to the whole thing. But Brian, then I did the homework. All right, let me look at what's really going on Social Security. And again, I'm for DOGE. You heard me on your show and other shows. I've been for DOGE, but it has to be done the right way.
Give me an idea of what you research yet.
So my research says that they haven't had a staffing increase in 50 years. They've passed audits in the Social Security that when he talks about 40% of the cases are fraud when they call, there's 8 million calls a day. 40%. It's 40% of the fraud that happens, which is 0.006%. Now, again, $1 spent.
I don't know what you just said.
So when there is fraud, and there is fraud, right? Sometimes checks go out the wrong way, and we got to crack down on it. So I'm all about that. But when Elon says on Brett Baer, hey, 40% of people who call in are committing fraud, that's not true. That's actually false. Now, I'm not saying he lied, because I'm sure he just messed it up.
No, it wasn't him. It was somebody else. What he says is 40% of the calls into Social Security are to change the direct deposit, and 40% of those people are fraudsters looking to redirect money to Brian Kilmeade's account instead of Patrick Murphy's account.
And
that's what he says.
And I'm telling you that that's not accurate. That's not, again, I taught that.
So if there's 100% of calls coming in, he's saying 4 out of the 10 are people looking to defraud people.
Right. And that there's 8 million calls a day. which means 40%, 3.2 million calls. There's not 3.2 million calls a day. And when you look at what they're doing, because they fired folks, they fired the deputy commissioner, et cetera, their website has crashed four times in the last 10 days. When you look at the fact that they're shutting down regional offices, field offices, and again, I'm for consolidation. Maybe you don't need all of them. That's part of DOGE and make it more efficient. I'm for that, right? But you got to communicate to the people. And I'm glad he did that. But sometimes the audio did not match the video. And that's why, Brian, I think, as relates to Wisconsin, as related last week in our special election in Pennsylvania, when a Democrat won in a district that Trump won by 15 points 2 months ago or 4 months ago, I think people were saying, hey, we didn't sign up for this. Talk to us. Communicate to us. So
But besides the people, the federal workers, that some have to go. You know, and by the way, they said some really nice things about the people that have been there, that they were enthusiastic about a chance to fix a system they know was broken, that the GAO says $500 billion worth of errant payments go out to people. That's what the GAO says before right. Musk was asked to go and donate his time for this. But when you saw those seven people, so I say things like, if we could just get the commuters to talk to each other, we're spending $100 million in order to keep our old system going. If we can modernize this system, right. So these are all, the word efficiency is circled.
Right, and listen, and I've been publicly about like someone like Doug Collins, our former colleague here who's right. Secretary of the VA. He just came out today, we're going to fast forward, we're doing Oracle and electronic health records. I'm for that. I'm positive on that. But he's doing it the right way. It was thoughtful, and he's rolling it out, and he's talking to it, and you're not seeing it when it comes to social.
But do you know that DOGE has nothing to do with VA right now?
No, I know that. Yeah, I know. I'm saying that in a positive way. But what I'm not saying is that you can't have Elon Musk saying, "Hey, I'm going to save Social Security," and people are going to get higher checks, which you're not going to get. And at the same time, he goes on Joe Rogan and says Social Security is a Ponzi scheme.
But do you know what he means by Ponzi scheme? Is because people have used Social Security and brought it to pay off other things, so they're moving money around. They're saying that, and the money does not equal when you and I are ready for it. If we don't increase our contributions, we will not be able to pay for it. So therefore, they got to take money from elsewhere.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
And Brian, this is why I love being on your show, because you're thoughtful about it, right? And I just did my first ever Substack on this issue talking about it. I'm saying, listen, when I had my father, Jack Murphy, who's 79 years old, who gets $1,900 a month. He did the Navy service during Vietnam. He did 22 years as a Philly cop. He did another 20 years for the state. He gets $1,900 a month, and he's getting fired up, and he's like, dude, what's going on? Patrick, like, why are they could, and I'm like, Dad.
Did they take his money?
No.
Is he worried
And he's worried about it. I said, Dad, relax. I said, but I go, the problem is that the American people don't trust what's going on right now. They don't trust government on both sides. And that's why we have to do a better effort to communicate to them. And that's why I talked about when you have, and again, I am for DOGE, but you got to do it the right way. And I don't think they're doing it the right way. They're really not. And especially when you look at the numbers. Now, again, but I'm for
it. See, I just don't know what is not right. The communication on the federal workers, maybe. Yeah. I mean, maybe some of those guys are being let go with emails. They didn't want to come back to work. Others have taken a package. Do you not believe those numbers when he said out of the federal workforce for us, 0.05 have been let go? Do you not believe those numbers?
I know that they try to get rid of 7,000 of the 50,000 in Social Security Administration. So that's 12%. So I didn't do my homework on that. I haven't fact-checked them. I don't do this.
It's impossible.
You know, right? I'm being honest with you, right? I don't know about that number, and I'm not going to accuse anyone for lying. I don't have TDS or anything, right? But I will say this. They tried to get rid of 7,000 people in the Social Security Administration. They've been flat, the same amount of people, for 50 years. And when we talk about reforms, we got to talk about when Social Security was first established, it was most Americans lived at 66. And they said, you get it at 65. It was three of every three workers in America were paying into the system.
Exactly.
Now it's two of them, one, right? That people like me and you who do pretty well for ourselves, we don't have to pay into Social Security after $166,000 a year, right? We got to come and we got to do this trust fund. So I agree with you, brother. And I'm not saying just tax the wealthy. We all got to get in this together.
Yeah, you got to pay much more.
But it has to be ready. It has to be ready, aim fire, not fire, aim ready, Brian.
But the thing is, though, what they're doing is they're looking at the structure, and they're also saying we don't need as many people if we're able to modernize the computer system. To me, Social Security is almost an automatic thing. You saw how much money it takes for someone to retire. How many people have to be involved? You can't retire right away. They could only do 8,000 a day.
So
that's
going to
change immediately.
Right.
And I was so encouraged by these software engineers coming in saying, oh, my God, this is 60 years old. Very few people can even maintain it. Therefore, we got to overpay for people that understand a system that's so old. I can fix it.
Right.
So you realize how much we're going to be able to save once these guys even leave Washington and go back home if we could fix the system. And that means you less people, right?
Right. And I agree with that, Brian. I really do. Right. And that's what Doug Collins in the VA, they're trying to use the Cobalt system. And he's electronic health records that it's called Vista, under 50 years ago. And there's not even coders anymore that can do that anymore, right? So, yeah, let's make sure let's focus on patients over paperwork and what they're trying to do, what Doug Collins is saying. I'm for that. What I'm not for, Brian, is that they're throwing out the baby with the bathwater here. Like, and I'm telling you, brother, like, he is not listening to President Trump when he says, use a scalpel, not a hatchet. When you're trying to get rid of 7,000 to 50,000 employees, which hasn't grown in 50 years, that are out there, and getting rid of regional offices and field offices without doing it in the right way, people are pissed. And you're going to see it in Wisconsin. You saw it in Pennsylvania.
But what exactly has been inefficient? They said the system has crashed three times in 10 weeks. They say it has nothing to do with them. They said they're not.
Listen, I'm not saying it's all Elon Musk. I'm not sitting here saying I don't have no hate in my heart. I teach at Wharton, where he's a graduate of, as is President Trump. I have no hate in my heart. Right? I want America to succeed.
No, but I don't think you have hate in your heart.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that what makes you think that Social Security can work more efficiently? Why do you think that workforce?
I think they can, and I think they should. Right? And I think we should.
And don't you, everywhere you go, like, for example, if you walk into our studio at Fox, we only have like one cameraman for four cameras. Yeah. If you walk into our control room, it's a third as big as it was. They've automated so much, and we're even slower than most. We have more human beings.
Right.
So that doesn't mean that we're more efficient. I think we are more efficient with less people.
And I think they could be more efficient, and I'm for it, right? But what I'm not for is when you say we're going to get rid of 7,000 folks, and that now, right now, because they did that, there's a three-hour delay when you call in. And when you call in now, and they're changing to all chatbots, and again, we should use that technology, et cetera. But when you're a senior that paid in this for decades and have a question about it, you shouldn't have to wait 3 hours on the goddamn phone.
Well, then you think that they cause a three-hour wait? You think Doge has been there for a month?
They've been there for 2 months.
Of three,
they're the ones that are fired, 7,000 folks. Brian.
But why not? It's 2025. Why should you have the same size workforce from 50 years ago?
Well, partially because you have double the amount of seniors that are collecting Social Security than you had 50 years ago.
But we have computers now. We don't number two pensions.
I agree, but we also have seniors that like my father, who literally calls the bank every day.
Thanks, Patrick.
All right, brother. Appreciate you having me on.
Now, the Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. By the way, I'm going to be outnumbered at 12 noon, so that's going to be exciting. And one of the things we did yesterday, when I'm Fox and Friends in the last minutes of the show, is one of the things we did is interview Kid Rock. Why? He set up a meeting with Bill Maher. And then Kid Rock's, interestingly, he brought Dana White. And one of the reasons he did, he goes, because Dana White is good at putting out fires should the tempers flare. So let's listen.
Still down 180. Look at the NASDAQ, though. Recovery there is now up 24 points. 10:51 Eastern time. Let's bring in Brian Kilmeade. Brian, Kid Rock was on the show earlier. He told us about his dinner with Trump, Bill Maher, and Dana White. Watch.
We talked about a lot of things that we had in common, which Bill Maher is a big, supporter of Trump's stance on the border, of ending wokeism. The president even asked him about policy, like what he thought with Iran getting a nuclear weapon and how Israel should react. Bill's a big supporter of Israel. We broke bread and talked about things we had in common, and it could not have been more cordial, more nice. I think everyone was so pleasantly surprised. And the president had called me a few days ago. He goes, what the hell you got me doing here? And maybe just maybe bring a little bit of civility back to this country for reasonable people.
What do you think, Brian?
I loved it. And he was on with us right before you.
Yeah.
And the one thing he did, he's on Bill Maher's show, and he notices what I notice, and you might notice too, is that 50% of what Bill Maher says is calling out Democrats. 50% he's upset at Trump on doing some certain things. But he also looked back and he said, we got to stop it. I'm not going to do what I did last time. I'm going to listen because the American people actually said something. And it was a lot of what he was saying of the idiocy that was happening in California with the energy, the idiocy what's happening with the cancel culture. And to me, it's not surprising that they got along. I thought maybe Bill Maher would look to dig in on issues they disagreed on, but it looks like they did none of that. And I think that 40% of what 40 to 50% of what Bill Maher believes, Trump believes, because Trump is not a typical conservative Republican, as you know better than anybody. He blends a lot, crosses party lines, and he leaves a lot of classic conservative Republicans spinning their head spinning, and some don't stop spinning, like Mitch McConnell. And I'll bring up one other thing that I think is important. Rachel Maddow wouldn't have worked. When Joe Scarborough and these guys came out and said, I'm going to listen to Trump now, it wouldn't have worked. They have no history of giving Trump the benefit of the doubt. The reason why Bill Maher worked is because he is on the record on his show, on his podcast, saying, well, Trump's not wrong about that, and he is wrong about this, and he's not wrong about that, and he is wrong about that. It's called balls and strikes. That's why I knew it would work, and I think that's why Kid Rock knew it would work.
Yeah, he got it. He got it. And next one for you, Brian. Tim Walz's daughter, well, she got into grad school. She's not going to attend. Listen to her explanation. Roll it.
I got into grad school. I will not be attending starting this fall, though. Given recent events, I am not going to give my money, go into debt for support institutions that don't support their students and the right to protest and, you know, speak out for their communities. Students deserve to be protected. I'm not worried about if I were to be protected or not at said institution. I'm, you know, privileged white woman.
Come on, Brian. I conclude that Tim Walz's daughter is in fact a supporter of Hamas. Where am I going wrong?
And all that crap of if you're a white person, you've had it too good for too long, and America's built on the backs of slaves. On stolen land. That's the whole 1619 mindset, and that is so yesterday's mindset. I was never happy when we were in yesterday's. She is actually acts like, as if these institutions care whether she goes or not, as if she's going into her debt with his dad, the governor of Minnesota, making a ton of money, doing his speeches, pretending people are interested in what he has to say. And she not doing this. You know, her major was sociology. Reagan was a sociology major, but her minor's in sexuality and whatever. So now we're going to find out if she could actually learn more about society and sex. She's going to have to wait a year, punish higher education because she won't go. It's that self-important, narcissistic behavior that is emblematic of so many on the way, way left, which I hear her mom is, and we know her dad is. Sorry, guys, I could not care less. And whatever you do, if you see this soundbite on social media, do yourself a favor. Don't play it. It is so painful to hear her go through this. And I'm really angry at you, Stuart, even though we started the day together in the elevator, for making me listen to it again. But I'm loving what's happening on college campuses. Back to academics. Foreign students accountable, be happy you're on a student visa, and know that if you start acting against our country, we're going to throw you the hell out of here and stop with the anti-American curriculum, or else you're going to lose your funding. I love
it. I hope I can run into you in an elevator at 4 o'clock in the morning any day of the week. Brian, you are all right. See you again soon.
Go get him, Stuart. And, of course, 1-866-4, I see 7 lines are filled if we want to get some names on them. I got about 3 minutes left, but when I was talking with Patrick Murphy on the last segment about Doge, I just couldn't disagree more. There were some things, and people got fired, the nuclear weapons people, nuclear maintenance people on nuclear weapons, and they were let go and they were called back. I got it. The emails could have been a little kinder when it said, basically, you're no longer working here. I understand that. But you have to understand how many people were not coming to work, collecting a paycheck, doing other things. Now they're complaining in a story today in the New York Times when they got back to work. Everything's a mess. Their desk, there's no running water, or the lights don't go on, or these things. Well, that means you got a terrible boss, and that means your system wasn't working. If you allow workers to come back into work and the lights don't work and the air conditioning doesn't work and the place is a mess, that's terrible management. And you should hold your manager accountable. And here's the other thing. Get yourself some Windex. Clean up your own desk. Work everything else out. You get on a ladder, fix the bulb. You got to go back to work. And I think that for the people that care about their job and want to fix it, they are loving Doge. For the people that don't want to work, never liked the job, and don't want to be accountable, they're the ones who are probably burning up Teslas and hoping that he doesn't last to play another day. The whole Doge thing. And Patrick Murphy, too. I always have great respect for him, but I totally disagree. Doge is doing great things for America, and when the political rhetoric calms down, they'll realize it. All right, Brian Kilmeade, we continue on. Don't move.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest minutes of the show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, but heard around the country, around the world. This hour, we're going to be joined by John McWhorter. He teaches linguistics, philosophy, and music history at Columbia University, author of the brand new book, Pronoun Trouble, The Story of Us. In seven little words, and he's one of the most brilliant people around. It's going to be interesting to talk to him. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
People sometimes think that under the Biden administration that he was simply asleep at the switch. No. They weren't asleep at the switch. It was a massive, large-scale program to import as many illegals as possible, ultimately to change the entire voting map of the United States.
He's 100% right. They had a mission, and it was thwarted. The Biden administration was not incompetent, so to speak, when it came to the broken border. It was intentional. We'll discuss it.
Number two.
Why tonight matters for Democrats is this is a chance for them to get off the mat. Like a big showing, a big win tonight, that's going to bring in money, energy. But I can tell you that inside the Republican Party, not a lot of optimism about Wisconsin. Down in Florida, feeling great.
Really? I think they're feeling great about Wisconsin, too. Gunning for the, special election. Gigantic implications. We're going to look at the stakes and the worry both sides have in both states.
Number one.
We have seen six high-profile university presidents resign, two of which are from Columbia, because these university presidents have failed to show moral, strong leadership. And President Trump, as he campaigned on, is holding them accountable.
I love it. Gunning for the eye of the arrogant anti-Semitic Ivy League colleges have their financial future in peril as the Trump administration is finding the troublemakers and examining the university funding, with Harvard and Princeton now getting the unwanted attention Columbia was receiving. A massive panic is setting in. I mean, Princeton has had a lot of their grants and funding frozen, right? And then you have Harvard now being looked at. They have $455 million for a total $8.5 billion they're getting from the federal government. They say it's for necessary research to save lives. But when you were asked to crack down on anti-Semitism, we watched it rage. But in your defense, you had a president that didn't seem to care. Everyone should be safe. You had a senator in New York who, Jewish, didn't seem to want to hear anything about it. Here is Batya Unger Sargon on the crackdown and the reaction around the country. Cut three.
It's so incredible because if you had told me, a month ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, that there was something that the government could do to stop the absolute downward fall of these universities from grace, I wouldn't have believed you. But it turns out that if you simply say to them, no more money until you stop discriminating against a minority population on your campus, suddenly they get their act together and they acquiesce to the demands of the government.
And it's kind of good, too, because they're not just showing the intolerance, stopping Jews from going to class, protesting against Israel, covering their faces as if they're training to be Yasser Arafat, pretending as if the radical Islam is something they subscribe to, or do they actually subscribe to it? Then we're looking at the foreign students who are rising up and we're wondering who's paying for them to be here. I have another question. Why are they getting in there? Harvard? How many kids do you know applied to Harvard and didn't get in? If you didn't play lacrosse or football, you're not getting in. 105 average, valedictorian, you got a shot. White guy, don't think so. But if you're a character coming from Syria living in London, it turns out if you're Mahmoud Khalil, you're getting in. Harvard is reviewing its $255 million in contracts, $8.7 billion in grants, all on pause. That task force that Trump formed is looking at all of it. The review includes more than the $8 billion in multi-year grant commitments to Harvard. Quote, Harvard has served as the symbol of the American dream for generations, the aspirations for students all over the world. And Secretary of Education Linda McMahon says Harvard's failure to protect students on campus from anti-Semitic discrimination has put its reputation in serious jeopardy, and now their money in serious jeopardy. I love it. Also, I mentioned about Princeton, $210 million on pause. The Trump administration's pausing it because, according to the Daily Caller, the funds are being paused while the administration investigates anti-Semitism that's been reported on their campus. Yep, they say Princeton has perpetuated racist and anti-Semitic policies. We'll see how high up the chain it goes, what they need to get it back. My problem is the complicity with Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic extremism. We're letting these people in, and we're letting the professors teach it. Really? Mark Goldfeder joined me on One Nation. He represents the seven hostage families who are suing this administration, Columbia, and against Hamas. Cut seven.
Students for Justice in Palestine and Within Our Lifetime, which are two of the groups that we just sued in the Southern District of New York. Here, by the way, is a thank you letter they got afterwards from the PFLP, another Hamas-affiliated terrorist organization, thanking them for their service to Hamas. And the beautiful part is when you hire these useful idiots to be your PR agents on American campuses, what you get are useful idiots who make useful idiot mistakes. So, for example, here is an actual recruitment flyer for Hamas that they handed out on campus, and it reads, "This is an intentional and coordinated effort to uphold the principles of Hamas, the PFLP, and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade."
Where did that appear?
September 24th, 2024, on Columbia's campus, handed it out by the CUAD, the group that Mahmoud Khalil represents.
And, I mean, you got so many people now deporting themselves, self-deporting, because they don't want to be arrested. They're trying to avoid. And that's fine. I don't care what happens to them. I want them off our campus, out of our colleges. This college student self-deported just days after suing Trump. This guy's name is, let me see. I got it here. It is Mamadou Tal, a doctoral student in African studies, had his student visa revoked due to his involvement in disruptive protest for disregarding university policies, creating a hostile environment for students, Jewish students. Is that okay with you? Mamadou says this, given what we have seen across the United States, I have lost faith that a favorable ruling from the courts would guarantee my personal safety. I have lost faith I could walk the streets without being abducted. Weighing up these options, I left. On his own terms. Good. Get out. And I wish you never came. And you have caused massive unrest and embarrassment to sober people who graduated from Cornell and just want to study at Cornell. Elise Stefanik started this by her incisive questioning when she brought up those college presidents and let everybody know how detached they were from reality. Now she's back among leadership, Republicans, no longer a candidate to be the UN ambassador. Cut four.
We have seen six high-profile university presidents resign, two of which are from Columbia, because these university presidents have failed to show moral, strong leadership. And President Trump, as he campaigned on, is holding them accountable. The decision to withhold federal funding from Columbia, that's what the American people wanted. That is what they voted for, because these universities have failed to make sure that they are following their own rules. They have failed to protect Jewish students. And we will continue to highlight a spotlight. But the fact that we're on the third Columbia University president, and this one, let's be honest, Maria, is not going to last as well.
So that's what we're talking about there, and I hope you're as pleased as I am. So I want to fast forward to something I have not talked about today, but I want to get to. That's Russia and Ukraine. We know that Ukraine is saying that Russia is not serious at all about coming to peace or ceasefire. They're up. They're upping the number of drone attacks, and they're ignoring the plea to leave the Black Sea and energy facilities off their hit list. They're still not doing it. Vladimir Putin saying it's an illegitimate government. I want Zelensky to leave and have the UN take over and have elections on his watch, which is not going to fly with Trump. He made it clear. He says, he's really ticked off at Vladimir Putin. Here's General Jack Keane on what Putin's up to. Cut 37.
What Putin is doing, it's an old Russian playbook that he's involved in here, which is, yeah, say you're interested in the ceasefire, interested in a peace agreement, but then throw a lot of obstacles and delays into that process. I mean, we're still negotiating the conditions of the original energy ceasefire, as well as some of the conditions for the Black Sea ceasefire. And the latest thing that Putin has thrown on the table is he wants some sanction relief before the Black Sea ceasefire is completed, much less go to the permanent ceasefire or a deal itself. So we're a long way away from all of that.
So Vladimir Putin, I kept everybody that says they study him says that he is evil, but he's not dumb. He is walking away from his best opportunity to get a degree of face back from his disastrous 3-year war in Ukraine. And Trump is his best opportunity. He's taking a lot of heat and going on the limb and saying, I just want these guys together to stop the fighting. Now, you embarrassed Trump. You lost your major ally. Now, he was golfing with the newest member of NATO, the Finnish president. And here's what he recommended. His name is Alexander Stubb. I actually interviewed him on One Nation. Cut 36.
The discussions I had with President Trump in Florida, I basically, two very simple messages. Number one, he is probably the only person in the world who can mediate the peace between Ukraine and Russia. Why? Because Putin respects and in many ways fears Donald Trump. Secondly, the point I had was that we need a ceasefire and we need a date for the ceasefire.
Yeah, put a deadline on it. Absolutely. At which time secondary sanctions go in, but more than anything else, the Ukrainians have to start drafting 18-year-olds and they got to make that public announcement. Right now it's 27. And number two is get them more weapons. You listen to The Brian Kilmeade Show. John McWhorter's next. His new book is Our Pronoun Trouble, The Story of Us in 7 Little Words. Don't move.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, John McWhorter is with us right now. He teaches linguistics, philosophy, and music history at Columbia University. Author of a brand new book out this week, Pronoun Trouble, The Story of Us in 7 Little Words. And Professor, great to see you. I know you're taking off this. It's a sabbatical for you, right?
Yeah, this is my leisure time, but here we are.
Normally at Columbia.
Yeah.
You must be so glad to be away from the chaos.
Honestly, it's not a fun campus to be on right now, and I love my institution, but yeah, it can be a sad place these days.
Right, but you also told me that it's not like the faculty interacts a lot, right?
No, I wouldn't say that. It's just that I happen to be in an eccentric situation, as always in my whole life, where linguistics is me and one other full-time faculty. We're kind of holed up in a building a little bit off campus. And so neither one of us have to interact with that many faculty. That's just by chance. The faculty themselves, they interact plenty, and they're having a very different experience than I've had.
So you love language.
I love language.
Where'd that come from?
I'm crazy. I mean, basically, when I was a little kid, I would hear another language and feel left out. It would almost make me cry. What are they saying? And how can I learn to do what they're doing? How come I only speak one thing? And for some reason, I'm just wired that way. It's an eccentricity. But that led me to study the languages of the world.
Right. And that led to this book, The Story of Us in 7 Little Words. What are those words?
Ultimately, they are I, you, he, she, it, we, and they.
Why?
And those words are our pronouns. And pronouns are important because they're not really words. A word is like cat or already or chin up or something like that, whereas pronouns are like nails. They're screws. They stand in for other things, and we use them an awful lot. And it means that if they change, and inevitably they're going to change, it's itchy. You don't like it because it's like somebody is telling you how to use your fingers.
But different times, different eras have different words.
Some
of the words in our era as opposed to the 50s that you go over in your book.
Yeah. And so the words are always changing. Fax is now an archaic word, but I remember in the 80s when it felt very new. Nowadays, the kids are saying, well, that's cringe. That's a new usage of that word. And words change. But pronouns, we don't like them when they change because that's kind of like, your shoe size changing or something like that.
So what are some words that represent this era and how is that indicative of what we're living through?
Well, for example, about 10 years ago, people started saying, well, we can't do that because feelings, or I'm doing that because salt. And the idea there is that you're doing a kind of a baby talk. You're talking kind of like a kid. And that's certainly partly because it's now part of being a young person to be a little bit afraid of or a little bit reluctant about being a grown-up, being an adult,
really?
Being a grown-up. That's something that's been shown many young people now worry about. And this is the whole conversation about kids being over-parented and kids not learning to be independent. It's this new cell phone generation. And I'm not meaning to criticize them, but I think that because feelings is a jolly reflection of that, in that you pretend to be talking in a childlike way, nobody would have come up with an expression like "because salt" in 1927.
I don't even know what that means. What's because?
Because salt would mean you don't want to eat that because you're not supposed to eat too much salty food. But instead of saying that, you say "because salt," and you just assume everybody knows what you're talking about. Just saying "because salt," it's really kind of boiling it down. It's assuming a lot. It's as if you're not really very articulate. It's pretending not to be articulate as a joke. That's something that adults in their fedoras would not have been doing in 1950.
So you saw it interesting. You observe, but you also notice, too, like the society's had the most success for people. You have that in contrast to the word grit. So grit is something you got to, you know, you got to find a way. You got to find it to grind it out. Overcoming obstacles. It's hard to do that when you're overparented or those obstacles are scaled for you.
Yeah, there is definitely some of that. We have a very advanced way of looking at grit these days, which is to question. And there's an intelligence in this, but you can take it too far, to question how hard people should have to work. The idea is that we should provide for people. We should make it easy. That the idea is that everybody has equal opportunity. The idea that you're going to really, really push, we often ask, how hard should anybody have to push? And that's also, especially if they are not upper class, and especially if they are, and I'm saying this as a black person, not white. There's a sense that how hard should we make people work, given that people start at different places. But that means that grit doesn't feel the same way to a lot of us now as it did in, I keep on mentioning 1950, but 1950.
You know what's so interesting? It's like when you lose everything, like in Los Angeles, when you, in the middle of a war, like the Ukrainians, they have their homes blown up tomorrow. You know exactly what you're doing the next day. It's survival instinct, right? It's almost a relief to get out that introspection of when am I fulfilling my destiny, my goal. You don't think that if you're in Kyiv these days.
You know,
don't think that if you're in Los Angeles, Pacific Palisades or Altadena.
Yeah, I would honestly say I know what you mean. I don't want to minimize what those people are going through. I wouldn't want to be in that situation myself. But I can think if there was one good thing about it, it would be that you knew that the only way to make this better is the grit, and there would be no questions. That there must be a tiny bit of relief in that, although this is not to minimize what happens to people.
Pronoun trouble. What do you mean by pronoun trouble? What's trouble?
Trouble is that whenever a pronoun changes in the way it's used, people get upset. And so, for example, "you" used to be only used if there were two or more people. It used to be that it would be Brian, "thou are sitting in front of me, thou art sitting in front of me," whereas "you" would be if it was you and somebody else here talking to us. And so we had both a "thou" singular and then "you" for the plural. "You" took over everything. And so "you" became used in both the singular and the plural. That feels natural to us now. That you can't imagine English as anything different. But when that was changing, there were people who didn't like it. And now here we are. There's some other things to be said about the use of "I" and "me." "Billy and me went to the store." Nobody thought that was a bad sentence until people decided that it was. But now we have the whole "they, them" business. And "they" is changing under our feet practically every week. And for a lot of people, it's a problem.
Are we going to ever stop seeing the pronouns at the bottom of emails? I mean, when is that going to go?
I think that that has become a jolly fashion statement to show that you understand that maybe we need to not think of there only being he's and she's, but some people who would rather not be referred to by a gender. And there are many people who want to show, you know, whether they want that or not for themselves, they want to show that they understand that gender is fluid. I think that's going to be a calling card for a long time. It's kind of like, I hate to say this about people who I'm sure were very sincere, but remember the Darfur War?
Well, let's see. Yeah, let's talk about that when we get back. More with Professor John McWhorter. Don't move.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So it's our privilege to have Professor John McWhorter in studio. He's taking a sabbatical. He doesn't have to miss class. His book is now Our Pronoun Trouble, The Story of Us in Seven Little Words. But I do want to pick up on what you were saying about Darfur.
I was just going to say, about 20 years ago, there were people who had signs on their lawn saying, "Not on our watch," about Darfur. And frankly,
the war passed for a while, but it came back, and it's now worse than ever. And back then, there was an extent, and it's not that people were being insincere, but there was an extent to which if you put up that sign, that was showing that you understood that people, and especially black people, were suffering in a different part of the world. We all do that. I think that the pronouns are a way of showing that you understand that the gender binary culturally doesn't have to be absolute. And frankly, I don't see anything wrong with it. I'm not going to be putting that I prefer to be called he, him. I think it's rather clear, and I have other stuff to do. But I think if you're of a certain age, you feel it as a kind of a politeness. It's like putting out a welcome mat.
Right. So, how do you feel about we're coming up on 250 years of American history?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that all races, all colors, all creeds should be celebrating that?
Well, to tell you the truth, I think that to suppose that the United States' history has been one long hit job, which is what we're often told, is lazy. I think it's easy to look at the bad things and to see it all in succession and to say that everything that's happening now shows that nothing has really changed and that we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. That's easy. And there's a certain drama in it, a melodrama in it. But the truth is that we started at a certain place, which was unusually advanced, the Declaration of Independence at the time, a really revolutionary document, as in it came from the French Revolution's ideas, except it actually worked and people didn't end up guillotining each other. And then it's been a long rehearsal where you get better with treating black people as equals. Not perfect in 1863, but that was better than 1862. And 1964 with the Civil Rights Act was better than 1863, et cetera. And then also with women and also with any number of other things where we get closer and closer to the ideal. It takes a little work to think of it that way because it's easier to pretend that progress doesn't happen than to admit that it happens slowly. But yes, by 250, I hope that we can really blow our own horn.
Right. Without skipping over Jim Crow, without skipping over slavery,
you
talk
over
about where we come and where we've evolved to. What is it like as a black kid in fifth or fourth grade when you first start hearing about American history and hearing about slavery? And were you in a mixed situation? It was an all black school.
Mm-hmm.
And how do people, what's the correct way to teach that? And how were you taught it?
You know, the truth is that I think the kind of a tabula rasa blank slate black kid hears about slavery now or heard about slavery in the 70s when I saw Roots on TV, et cetera. And my mother was very conscious of teaching me things like this. And what you think is that's over. You think that was then, that was a damn shame and then some, but here we are now. That's what you first think. Then you're taught to think, and this happens, I think, more in college than in most schools, but you're taught to think that actually there hasn't been that much progress and that there's a straight line between slavery and, for example, what happened to George Floyd and the fact that somebody might give you a funny look in a store. I think you learn that later, and I think that that's a dangerous message because the truth is you try to make the best of what you've got, even if a disproportionate number of the people you are mm-hmm. are starting from behind. I grew up in a very middle class and very integrated circumstance, and I don't think that's why I said what I just said. I think in general, even less advantaged black kids who grew up in all black neighborhoods hear about slavery and they think of it as something distant, and I know for a lot of people they shudder at the thought, don't think that it was so distant, but frankly, it was, and I think that a healthy self-image is to think about yourself more than what the obstacles were for your great-great-great-great-grandparents.
I know, and as we come up in year 250, I think it's going to be, hopefully people can all say everything you said and feel good about the country. This is your team, right? This is your team.
And we're here now.
We watch Greenland. Greenland is old. They have 20,000 people. They mm-hmm. have great pride.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, they don't want to be owned by anyone. Mm-hmm. And I want to get back to the point where if people insult America, everybody feels it. They don't say, yeah, I hear you. I'm stuck here. Right? Because I think people have to compare us to other countries. How do we do when you do that, John?
Yeah, I think people need to realize that to have criticism of America, it's one thing to love America and to wish it got better, but to listen to it being criticized from other places and to nod as if you hate your own country. Basically, just make sure that you're being honest. I honestly believe that if that's how you feel, you should really be considering, and there are some people who do it, but very few, go to Germany, go
therefore to Canada, which is a lot like the United States, but has less of what you would think of as the blood on its hands. Or go live in, you know, Russia is a very interesting place. Go live there. And to the extent that most of those people would never do that, basically, because they have, you know, kinship ties here, friends here, mm-hmm. and frankly, wouldn't want to live anywhere else. It means you should love your country despite criticizing it. Yeah, definitely.
What is it like on campus now with this anti-Semitism that we saw on full display over the last couple of years since the October 7th attacks?
Well, the truth is I'm on sabbatical this year, and so I haven't been on campus. But what that comes down to is why people are so upset about a war going on in a very small place very far away is that they see it as white people on brown people. So they see it as white supremacy or what's called settler colonialism. And it is oppressing the Palestinians who are brown. And it doesn't matter that most Israelis are not technically Caucasian or white. The idea is that Israel was founded by the larger Western white establishment.
And mostly the lead constitutions don't believe Israel should exist?
Most people who teach, well, you know what? I don't know the statistics. I'll say that I have known ever since I was a teacher, you know, first at Cornell, then at Berkeley, and then at Columbia, that it is a very common, not at all surprising opinion among faculty, especially humanities and social science faculty, that Israel was a mistake. Very few people have a rabid view about it, but it's very common at a dinner party to hear somebody just say it, especially if a Jewish person isn't there. And it was very common when I was a graduate student, when I was at Stanford. That was a very ordinary view. And it's not that these people would want to see Israel pushed into the sea, but their idea was Israel shouldn't have happened, and how Israel treats Palestinians now is something like a genocide. That did not shock me a year ago the way it shocked many people, because if you're in university culture, you know that that's long been the standard.
We're stunned how much money goes from the federal government to these institutions. Harvard gets $8.5 billion in payments. $400 million is a portion that is being withheld from Columbia right now. Do they need that money?
They do need it, Brian. And to be honest there, I have to say, the solution to fixing this is not to threaten scientific research, which is what's going on here. If what they're trying to do is say, either change this and really go to an effort that you weren't going to before and that there was no way to make you go to, or we're going to take away your science money. If the idea is just a gambit, I get it. But if what they really mean is that we're going to stop studies cold, we're going to stop the kind of science that you need to do, honestly, the science is more important. This is not what you want to hear, but the science is more important than anti-Semitism.
Fine. Well, but what would get these colleges' attention?
To be honest, I think it would have to be, one, maybe this. I mean, maybe this will just shock these schools to their socks to the point that they really do work on making it so that there's no more tolerance of anti-Semitism than there would be of a bunch of white kids saying DEI must die and walking around with pickets. You know, if those kids did that, they would be sent to the planet Jupiter right away. But somehow it's okay to say from the river to the sea. Maybe this gambit will work. Or if it doesn't, there has to be a national conversation about it. And these things take time. But, you know, there are things that change. And so, for example, there is no epidemic of teen pregnancy anymore. If anybody is saying babies are having babies in the ghetto, they're talking about something that really hasn't been true for about 20 years. In this case, we could wake up 20 years later and notice that there's been a shift in terms of campus anti-Semitism. And maybe it would be because of all of this that's happened.
Yeah, I guess we're going to have to see. The other thing would be the foreign students. I'm just shocked how many foreign students are on campus. I know how many very successful high school students just don't have a shot at the Ivy Leagues, of all, especially white kids these days.
Well, they pay the freight, for one thing. And to be honest, that's been a reality I have lived in so often that I had not really thought about it that much. But yes, there are a great many students from other places, and they do – that there is an amount of the space that their admission takes up that maybe if we could change things, more disadvantaged American kids of all colors would come in for.
So people just tuning in now, pronoun trouble's out today.
Today is its first day.
What do you want people to take from the book?
I want them to take from it, one, that every one of those little words has an interesting history, and two, that almost all of them have been controversial at some point, so the history is interesting. And three, to know that it's not too long and that some people tell me that it's funny. That's pronoun trouble.
Right, and who does your intro?
The intro is you mean
the dedication, the first, don't you have an introduction to your book?
It is dedicated to my Russian partner.
Right.
And so that's what that says. And so that's to mine. And that's who it was dedicated to.
Right. Right now in our country, the tariffs, I know you're not an economics guy. So you worry about it?
Yes, because I think that, for example, with the cars are going to be more expensive. And that's hard for people because people like to buy cars. Apparently, that's going to hit wealthier people more than people who aren't wealthy and are more likely to buy American cars. But American parts are often made in other places. I think it's a rather heartless policy.
But yeah, I guess we're going to see what happens if we can rebalance everything. And so John, where do we go to get the book?
You go to your friendly bookseller, or frankly, there are many places online that you can go to get the book. And it's also an audio book, and frankly, I read the audio for it, and so I recommend that as well.
I want you to hear Governor Gavin Newsom, March 6th, on should men be in women's sports.
I think it's an issue of fairness. I completely agree with you on that. It is an issue of fairness.
So
it's deeply unfair. I'm not wrestling with the fairness issue. I totally agree with you.
Now that's on trial today, he's saying that maybe he has a second visit to that. How do you feel about trans men in women's sports?
Honestly, if someone has gone through male puberty and then has decided that they are a girl, I understand the I am a girl part. But if you've been through male puberty, I don't think you should be able to compete against women in sports. I'm mystified that somebody who's been through male puberty would then go into a female space and say, I'm one of you, and win and be fist bumping in the air as if that's some kind of victory. I think that is going to be one of the oddest things about the 20-teens and 2020s in, say, 2050 when we look back. That clearly just isn't fair.
Yeah, and to me, it's one of these issues where Democrats are holding on to. In fact, I was talking to Jason Crow, he was in last week, and I just said, well, how do you feel about it? He goes, well, it rarely happens. He goes, well, how do you, I just tell me what you think. But if you have a daughter or a sister or a cousin, you play soccer against them, you play field hockey
and
against
trained
them, it is
for
dangerous.
Years. It's dangerous because men are, on the average, stronger than women. No, it's really, really not fair. And I think that anybody who competes under those conditions, I'd like to talk to them and say, how do you feel like it was a significant victory? And that might mean either there will be trans sports or maybe a person like that should choose to compete in some other way because they've had that unusual life history. But no, it's transparently unfair.
Professor, lastly, is cancel culture over?
It's never going to be what it was in 20 and 21. I think that this defenestration, this throwing people out of windows from the hard left that happened, I think we tend to forget a lot of that happened on Zoom and on Slack. It wasn't people sitting in real rooms. And it was people who were lonely and bored and feeling tribal because of the lockdown. There was a big, talk about how you change the anti-Semitism on campuses. There was a massive conversation. There was a backlash against that. I participated in it. And I think that it worked. And so, yes, there are people who are hyper woke, who are hyper upset. A lot of them now have concentrated on the Gaza conflict, for example, because here out in the rest of the world, it's harder for them to have the sway that they used to.
If you want to feel smarter and more incisive and be more impressive at the hanging out in the bar tonight or tomorrow, pick up Pronoun Trouble. Get right through it. The Story of Us in seven little words. It's entertaining and interesting, as in everything you do. Professor, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Brian.
Hey, back with more to know, and then top of the hour, Outnumbered. You're listening to Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Scientists say that they've developed a way of making foie gras that does not involve force-feeding ducks. Wow, that's great, said ducks. What about the murder?
I'm not even sure what foie gras is, but that is true. You force-feed ducks and you kill them and eat them, right?
Yeah, because then they make it out of their liver, because by force-feeding them, getting them nice and fat, they get a good fat liver, and then you can make more foie gras.
Did you play that because you think I need to know more?
I think so.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
All right, what about this question from Peter Ducey to Donald Trump? He says, I know it's not at the top of the list, but listen.
Tiger actually called me a few months ago, and you'd have a very special, very good relationship with Tiger. I played golf with him a couple of times over the last month. And he's a fantastic guy and a fantastic athlete. And he told me about it. And I said, Tiger, that's good. That's good. I'm very happy for both. I just let them both be happy.
Right. And he said it's sad that they divorced. Don Jr. and Vanessa divorced. They have five great kids. We know about Kai and all these others. He says they're all great athletes. It was kind of real. It was like a very grandfatherly friend, odd situation. And he did indicate, too, that, you know, maybe if they didn't have the whole Russia mess and put all the pressure on Don Jr., wouldn't have put pressure on the marriage. I have no idea, but that was interesting, right?
No, the whole cut was so fascinating. That, like, just like a little window into his brain, but also Don and Vanessa's relationship. He did, if it wasn't for the Russia, who knows if they'd be there today. But he really did speak so lovingly of Vanessa, which I thought said a lot.
Right. And now he's got another girlfriend, and I don't know, maybe things are going to work out. Next, NFL great Richard Sherman says armed robbers broke into his home with his family inside. He played 11 years with the 49ers and Tampa Bay Bucks and Seahawks. He posted screenshots of a video of the alleged perpetrators inside his Washington State home one day before his 37th birthday. He says, my house is being robbed at gunpoint with my family in. It isn't what anyone else wants for a birthday gift. Scary situation that my wife handled masterfully and kept my kids safe. Wow. Next, Yankee catcher J.C. Asara clearly thinks that those barking about New York's new torpedo bats should pipe down. It changed the meat of the bat, the thickness of the bat, to a different part of the bat. Totally legal, totally above board, but the Yankees got off to a great start. Here's what he told TMZ Sports.
The torpedo bats, man, you know, people are making it a big deal right now, but they've been around for a while. And, you know, it's not just us that are using them. You know, I've seen them with other teams too. You know, five, six other teams are using them as well. At the end of the day, you know, you still got to swing the bat and hit the ball in the barrel. So, you know, we're always finding new ways to get better, and this is just where the game's going.
Wow, that's pretty interesting, right? This is where it's going. We'll see. Aaron Judge is not using the bat. Has got, I think, four home runs to start the year. Next, Miller Gardner may have died of carbon monoxide poisoning. I'm talking about Brett Gardner's son, who passed away at the age of 14 while on vacation with his family. At first, they thought it was he got sick from some type of food poisoning and choked to death. But now they say carbon monoxide. Oh, my goodness. This is an elite. This is a five-star resort in Costa Rica.
But then also, I mean, the whole family is there. It's all just devastating.
Well, why just him, right?
Agreed,
his
exactly.
His own room. Next, Full House star Dave Coulier declared cancer-free. Dave completed his chemotherapy treatments in February. Candace Cameron Bure, who starred alongside him, celebrated the recovery in social media posts, sharing photos of them together. Hey, Watchmen outnumbered in a matter of minutes. And don't forget to see me at History, Liberty, and Laughs. June 21st in Dayton, Ohio.
Fox News Audio presents the Fox Nation Investigates podcast, Evil Next Door, exploring the life and crimes of five serial predators from across the United States.
It's a very disturbing case.
In never-before-heard interviews and first-hand perspectives.
Described as pure evil, that's a good description.
The Fox Nation Investigates podcast, Evil Next Door. Listen and follow now with Amazon Music. Must listen to podcasts from Fox News Audio. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.